And I started my career on Wall Street like 1 year before the 1987 crash. You can literally remember every single moment of that day because it was just so insane. It truly was. And it was probably like a great lifetime lesson to me about how things can go wrong so bad, so fast, and you cannot even imagine. And that's why, you know, that's why I have such a hard time with all the furos on YouTube who like think that, you know, if you have a single candle, that you can predict future behavior, or that supply from 1945 on the candle,
right,
is
like it's still gonna matter.
I cannot stand ICT. I mean, I just think it's the biggest scam there is. And the whole model of brokerage was it was a dealer-based model. So it means you are in off exchange markets. We'll talk about this, with the difference between futures and CFDs. In off exchange markets, the dealers are making the market. There's only two positions you really want to have. You want to be flat or you want to be long.
Right there. That's a good nugget, yeah. Right there. Do you know how I know you're not a short?
Yeah.
You still have your hair.
Here's why I love futures prop.
What's up, traders? Welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm sitting down with a very special guest. We are in New York City to talk to Boris Schlossberg. Boris has extensive trading experience. He has some very strong opinions and also shares some really awesome trading stories. We talk about the crash of 1987, how it was to be working at a firm when that happened. We talk about even the trading he does today. He shares his opinion on ICT and all the different ways that people think you can make money in markets nowadays. So I think a lot of you guys are going to enjoy this episode. Please make sure you're subscribed. Make sure you check out the links down in the description. Thank you to our sponsors for making the traveling happen, making these podcast studios happen, and helping us grow the show. So enough out of me. Let's get in and chat with Boris. Real quick, traders, a break from the video to thank the sponsor, ASFX TV. Now, if you don't know what ASFX TV is, it's our live streaming platform where we trade live New York session and London session every single day of the week. Of course, minus like a bank holiday here or there. But if you want to watch me and our team of funded full-time traders live, navigating the market, calling trades, taking wins, taking losses, managing the trades, and everything in between, come check out ASFX TV. There's a link in the description or flying in above my head for a 3-day free trial. It's a no-brainer. You got nothing to lose. Come see if there's something to be learned while watching guys who have a combined 20 years of market experience navigate through the markets. Also, you'll get access to the replays of previous streams, so if you can't be there live, you still can learn, watch, and follow along. Again, it's a no-brainer. It's 3 days on a free trial and then $10 per month. So shout out to the ASFX TV team for sponsoring this video. I want you guys to check out that link in the description to come try out the trial. And let's get back to the video. All right, Boris.
Yes, sir.
Good to have you back on the show.
Good to be here.
We are in your neck of the woods today.
We are. We are in New York City. We're in Brooklyn, Navy Yards. Right?
It's going to be good. So let's jump in.
Yes, sir.
I think that you have some credentials that people maybe don't know about. First of all, when people Google Boris Schlossberg, yeah, a lot comes up. But one thing that stands out is you have an Investopedia page, which I think is super dope. Do you know how that ever came about? Did that just become natural?
No, it just came natural. It's just a nice way of you saying that I'm super old. That's all it is. You know?
Not at all. Not at all. But I think it's cool because that means you have a, we'll call it, tenured experience in this industry.
Exactly.
So I wanted to talk.
Graduate from the School of Hard Knocks.
Exactly.
Yes.
So before we get into it,
right,
how do you tell people today when you're walking in to get your bagel or your coffee, right, whatever you're doing, when people say, what do you do? What do you say nowadays? I'm curious.
What do I say these days?
If I'm a stranger and I say, I like your watch, you know, you're just hanging out in sneakers in the middle of the day in a Starbucks, what do you do? What do you say
to
those people?
I still struggle with an explanation for that because it's such an obscure little land of the world. I usually say I'm just a pretty face on TV. That's what I say. And I just try to laugh it off for most people because it's just a little hard to explain to the layman exactly what we do, why we do it, and, you know, what it's all about. So I skipped that explanation.
Okay, so then let me intro you. So for those of you that don't know Boris, Boris is a regular contributor on CNBC.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge part of what you do.
Yeah.
Boris also runs BK FX with Kathy Lean.
BK Traders.
BK Traders now.
Right.
And Boris and I today are going to talk with you guys a lot about the futures funding space, the prop funding
space,
all of this drama. But before we get into that, of course, we're going to save that for the middle of the episode.
Yes.
Let's talk about your background.
Because
I don't hear about this in any of your other videos, and I think it's really interesting.
Again, it's because I'm so old, right? But it's fine.
It's not that at all. It's not that at all. Yes. So you started at Drexel, Burnham, and Lambert.
Yes, Drexel Burnham Lambert, otherwise known as Drexel Burnham and Churnham.
What is that?
So Drexel Burnham and, oh my God, I have to explain this to now. This is
there's gonna be a lot of people that
because
don't
you have to understand Drexel Burnham Lambert was literally the firm on Wall Street.
Really?
It was Michael Milken. If you have to go back all the way to the 1980s, Junk Bond King.
Okay.
Michael Milken was the master of the universe. If you ever see the movie Wall Street,
okay,
it was based on a guy named Ivan Boesky, who was the client of Michael Milken, who
really?
Was not like the character in Wall Street is actually the lower level character of who the guy who you know we all work for, who's Michael Milken, who literally owned all of Wall Street. He invented junk bonds.
Really?
He financed Steve Wynn, by the way. He financed all of Las
the
Vegas.
Casinos.
Yeah, the casinos.
Wow.
Doing it this way. And I came in, I was not involved. He moved to California and he was working out of LA. I worked out of the New York office, which was literally right next door to the New York Stock Exchange. It's 55 Broad Street. It was really, really a lot of fun. It was you know, the swinging 80s. And I started my career on Wall Street like 1 year before the 1987 crash.
Really?
And I survived, and I was like this young puppy on the desk during the 1987 crash, which is still to this day the single most surreal experience of my trading career.
I can only imagine.
There are people always remember their certain days in their life. They remember every single moment.
They remember 9/11.
Right.
Their child's birth. Wedding.
Correct.
And the crash of 1987.
You can literally remember every single moment of that day because it was just so insane. It truly was. And it was probably like a great lifetime lesson to me about how things can go wrong so bad so fast. And you cannot even imagine. You know, one of the interesting things about 1987 crash people absolutely do not understand is that during 1987 crash, we had the greatest rally the stock market had ever seen.
Because V bottomed?
There was a V bottom at 11 o'clock in the morning. It went up 212 Dow points, which is the equivalent, I guess, of like maybe 20,000 Dow points at this point. Like imagine a 20,000 Dow point rally until about 2:30 p.m. And then it died and it just died. And we started just selling. And I remember grown men crying. I mean, it was at that point, there was many, many specialists on the New York Stock Exchange who had thought they survived this. Literally that last hour and a half.
It killed them.
It bankrupted them.
What was your job then? What were you doing? Were you
I was brokering.
You were calling people.
I was calling people, you know, I was just, you know, it was straight up.
I picture right now everybody's, all the younger generation is picturing that scene of Wolf of Wall Street where he's throwing somebody's like, pick up the phone, start dialing.
Exactly. Except, you know, it was a lot more upscale than Wolf of Wall Street because it was a sort of top end, top tier firm.
How did you get the job there?
I interviewed, what did I do?
Did you have a degree?
Oh God, this was crazy. So I started, I graduated Columbia University, right, in 1985.
With a degree in?
A concentration in economics. I was too lazy to get a degree, so I got a concentration in economics. And to this day, probably, it's just how life goes. I interviewed with a Federal Reserve Bank of New York FX desk, FX spot desk, right? And they were like, they were willing to offer me a job because I was like, you know, this kid out of Columbia that was relatively articulate. And I was like, this doesn't sound so good. Like, I cannot believe to this day that
That's
I passed
crazy.
Up. Like, this, there were three people in that at that time making markets for FedEx on the FX desk. And I was like, it's okay. You know, I think I want to try something else. So then I actually wound up getting a job for a financial PR firm, which is actually still in business, that used to do like work for stocks. And I was like, you know, I used to represent I had very good writing skills, which has always carried me through my whole life, basically. And I got bored with that about a year into it. And I said, I really, really want to trade. And I actually started cold writing to all these famous brokers. There was this broker named Andrew Lanier, who was like a friend of George Soros's, who was like a really, really famous Hungarian broker. And I wrote him a letter saying, hey, I'm an immigrant just like you. You know, and he like actually took me to breakfast early in the morning. He was so impressed with, you know, my letters. And then I just realized, you know, maybe I should try some of these programs. And that's how I got into, you know, the Drexel program. At that time, Drexel was like you understand, it was Goldman Sachs, Drexel Burnham and Salomon Brothers. That's how Merrill Lynch was like not even, you know, below that. That's how high end it was at that point.
Wow.
But it was, you know, it was definitely a surreal experience.
And how long did you stay with Drexel?
And I stayed with them for a couple of years. And then actually after the crash, I left.
After the crash.
And it was funny because I literally left Wall Street for a very, very long time. This was the beginning 90s or the beginning of the high tech, this is 1985, I think. Yeah, there was this kind of a lull period where I don't remember what I did in the lull period. Oh, I think I know what it was. There was in the lull period. I went into the restaurant business for a long time because I loved restaurants. It was actually a great experience. I did front of the house, back of the house. I loved the idea, the romance of restaurants. After
what type of food?
Everything, Italian, high end. It was crazy.
Falafel.
No,
Mediterranean. You stick to my
retirement dream, which will never happen, is that I'm gonna retire somewhere and I'm gonna create a restaurant called Jews Cook Italian because I can.
Jews can cook Italian pretty well.
I can, I put mine up against anybody.
Episode number two with Boris is gonna be in your house. Cooking and we're having food.
My pasta puttanesca will go up against anybody. But anyways, yeah. So I loved it, but it was great experience of I never want to do this for the rest of my life because it was just the most grinding thing. And what happened was. Technology had really started to pick up. Netscape had gone public in 1995. My wife, who was my first wife at the time, who was a headhunter, said, we really should start headhunting all this high-tech talent. And we literally just started a business out of our house that just blew up. You can imagine, I placed people into Google, I placed people into Yahoo, I placed people into Netscape. It was just insane. And that was another great bubble. So I was like the character Zelig from Woody Allen movie. I was at every, high-end event in history. I was during the 1987 crash, I was right on the desk, and then during the high-tech bubble, I was literally flying to California every 2 months to San Francisco.
Wow.
So here's the lesson from that. We negotiated something like $50, $60 million worth of stock compensation for all the people that we did in high technology. How many of those guys do you think cashed in?
2%.
One guy cashed in for $2 million of stock. Everybody else's stock blew up because everybody stayed too greedy. Nobody
cashed out.
Nobody
realized their gains.
Nobody realized their gains.
Lesson number one, everybody.
Lesson number one.
Realize gains.
Which it's funny. It's funny. My youngest one, we were at dinner yesterday, and she's fascinated. Now she's about 11. She's fascinated with what I do. My wife is an ex-hedge fund manager. So she's like, mommy trades for 3 years and she trades for $100,000. Daddy trades for 5 minutes and he trades for $10. And I go, that's right. But she's so smart. She goes, because daddy wants the money now. I go, that's right. I want the money now. And it's fascinating. She was so brilliant. She understood that all of my early experiences of life taught me that money now is much more important than money later.
Like you just said, realize.
And I'm absolutely incapable of doing what my wife does. My wife is incredible at she'll hold. She was in Weatherford, which is this drilling company.
Okay.
It's a 10x. She bought it at 18. It's 150. It's a 10x return for her.
Wow.
I couldn't do a 10 basis point return.
it's also about knowing yourself. You know yourself, you're saying, your background built you into this person that's a quick decision maker, quick thinker.
Right.
Exactly. I don't know where this is going to be tomorrow.
But also my early experiences, because remember, also my early experiences, for example, with investing, right? I invest, my older children, all of their stock money went into the stock market in 1999, 2000. And by the time they were ready to graduate, it was 2008 and it made no money.
So it makes you jaded a little bit.
And it was a terrible experience because honestly, I've probably given up millions of dollars of not investing money because all my IRA money just sits in cash. People are like, you're a fucking idiot. Pardon my language.
But I'm like,
I don't care because that's not who I am.
Right.
I'm perfectly happy just like an immigrant to keep it in the savings bank because I am incapable of just this long-term investment perspective because my early experiences just taught me take the money now, otherwise the money goes like an ice cube.
I think when you've been through enough experiences and you've been around the block a long time, you see so many other people hold the bag too long, like those guys that you just mentioned, and you learn. You have to be.
Before
we go away from the crash, biggest, can you just kind of explain to us that day, biggest takeaway from that day for you long term? I mean, you said you saw grown men crying. So you went home that day, what were you thinking?
Was
it shock?
You're in a daze. Remember, there was a very real chance that the whole financial system
was going to collapse the next day.
Right.
Because it was a Thursday, I believe.
Okay,
right?
No, this was
a Monday.
It was a Monday. Okay, so this is fascinating because I was just listening to documentary replays of it and I remembered all of it really, really clearly. So that Monday, what happened is Alan Greenspan gets on a plane, the market crashes, he gets off the plane and they say to him, it's down 527. He goes, oh, 5.27 points?
No.
That's not too bad? They go, no,
527
points. Right. And he freaks out. And he's like, oh, my God, we have to start pumping money to, you know, we have to start
a money printer.
A money printer because, you know, everybody's going to need. And he starts calling the banks and telling them, you have to loan. You don't have a choice. You have to. He starts calling Chase and Citi. You have to loan to the specialist because, you know, you don't have a choice. We need. So they're like refusing to do it. They try to open the market on Tuesday morning. Specialists have no capital. There's no bids. Everybody is at offer. The only exchange that actually refuses to close, and there's an enormous amount of pressure on exchanges to close, and they're afraid that if they close the stock market, close the NYSE, close everything, they won't be able to reopen them.
Right, there's create a run on the banks, yeah, to create a good scenario.
There'll be a run on the bank. It'll be like 1932 all over again.
Right.
Right? And so there was this one guy, I forgot his name, Brett something, who was an options trader, but he basically realized that whenever they closed markets, after they reopened them, they gapped up a lot. Mm. So he was like, we're gonna go onto the exchange and start buying everything we can before. And he was like, and most of the guys didn't even have clearance from their clearing firms because they didn't have no money in the account. Yeah. He had money, he started buying, and that created basically the big rally.
He made the market.
He made the market by himself, 150 contracts of MMI, which was a very, very like a levered product.
Yeah.
And and that turned the market. And wow. So the whole point is I realized that people think that, you know, there's something concrete to this world. They think money is concrete. Everything is virtual. Everything is, in fact, an emotion, you know? And that emotion can change on a dime down and change on a dime up, you know? And you have to understand it. So your long-term, you know, Warren Buffett said, long-term, the market is a weighing machine. Absolutely. But in the short term, there is no reason why S&P could not drop, well, because of circuit breakers, maybe that's the only reason. It cannot drop 20% in a week.
Right.
Easy.
Right.
Easy. And you'd be shocked.
Right.
You know. And you're like, all of a sudden, you know, these people who have like, oh, look at my return. I've compounded for the last 10 years. All my savings there. My 401k went from 100,000 to 500,000. All the financial planners on YouTube who are very good at projecting. This is how much money you're going to have for your retirement. You could wake up very easily with thinking you have $1 million portfolio for retirement at the age of 65, and at the age of 65 in day one, it'll be $500,000.
I hope you're enjoying today's video. Just want to give a shout out to the sponsor, Top One Trader. If you're looking to get funded, I've got a link and a discount code for you down below that's going to save you big bucks on your next funding challenge. So thank you to Top One, and let's get back to the video.
And you will not have any idea whether you're going to get back to $1 million or not, or whether it's going to take you a year or maybe the rest of your life.
Crazy.
That's the thing that people, I think, absolutely don't appreciate about the finicky aspect of financial markets.
So let me ask you this. A lot of people say, we've had that crash,
yeah.
Black Monday. Did you know, out of the 6 worst days in stock market history, 4 of them happened on Monday or Tuesday?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
I'm not surprised, yeah.
But what I was going to say is, a lot of people say, when those events happen, yeah. The market adapts. We put in circuit breakers,
we do
things differently,
right.
And it won't happen again. What do you say to that?
No, it will happen again. It will just happen differently. It always happens differently. The thing that we have learned, which is very, very good, is we've learned that it's an artificial game. It used to be like, you know, when the market crashed in 1929, they thought it was an act of God, that this is natural, you know, that the markets are a natural way of, and that, you know, and what is it, Carnegie, I forgot who said, you know, you need to liquidate. Everything is artificial. Everything is social. Like there's nothing at all natural about markets. It's a social construct. Money is a social construct. So people don't understand. People think, oh, I want hard money, gold. I'm like, it's a social construct,
yeah.
You know?
It really is.
Money doesn't exist. What people don't understand is that you do not have money. You just have a little ledger transaction, whether you have a dollar or $1 billion sitting. Jeff Bezos can be bankrupted tomorrow if somebody flipped the digits in his account. He'd be worth nothing.
Right.
It's all completely.
Even more now than ever because
right.
It's so digital now.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's all a social construct. Like there is no actual value, quote unquote value. And we live in a society. So society fortunately has gotten smarter and learned how to adapt to all of these things. So
you think that there still will be things throughout history, as long as markets exist, that cause these black swan events?
100%. Because markets always follow the crowding behavior. By the very nature of human beings, because we're social animals, is to follow
the delusion of the crowd, right? There's the book.
It's not even the delusion. Just we follow what everybody else is doing, sure. Right? Like if you, they do all these experiments where, you know, if everybody's walking towards a certain area, you know, at a concert, you go, oh, this is the line to go to, right?
And you just stand there. You're not even asking
questions.
That could
be the line to the bathroom. And
exactly.
And the ticket line is completely 100%. Different, right? So we're all social animals. And so are dogs. Like, watch dogs. They are, you know, they're like a great example of who we are. We think we're much more evolved. We're not. We're basically just a you know, bigger brain dogs. We all follow a social construct. So when people just, you know, like right now, everybody crowding into AI and crowding into those spaces, that creates such a over-levered impact that eventually there's a cascade. One guy, it's like a game of Jenga. One guy says, sell, and everybody says, oh, there's no more buyers. And then, you know, and that's why, you know, that's why you have like, we had a couple of weeks ago, we had like a 300-400 point decline in the S&P, just like, you know, boom, in the last half hour.
Yeah.
So handicapped. It's so obvious, you know.
What creates these moments? The crash of 19... 19-
Nobody knows. That's
Nobody
the thing.
Knows.
That's the thing. If you were there on Friday, there was literally no reason. It was no reason. It was just because. And that's the thing. It's not like people love to
conspiracy.
Retrofit history.
But they think conspiracy about it.
Yeah. There was zero reason.
And that goes back to what because I talk to people like you who have a lot more experience than me, I've got this opinion about markets that only markets know where they're going to go. Correct. No hedge fund manager actually knows.
Of course not. Yeah.
But like you said, it could be one of the big guys that starts to sell, another big guy follows, starts to sell, the smaller guys start to sell, then it all falls apart, right?
Right.
So
exactly.
It really just takes a couple of influential people to start to dump for us to see a big dump.
Correct.
Okay. Interesting.
You know, and that's why, you know, that's why I have such a hard time with all the furos on YouTube who like think that, you know, if you have a single candle that you can predict future behavior, or that supply from 1945 on the candle
right,
is
like it's still gonna
like
matter.
I cannot stand ICT. I mean, I just think it's the biggest scam there is in terms of, there's no such thing as a liquidity grab. If you understand how markets actually move, it's somebody who has demand to buy, somebody has demand to sell, and they could care less that you think that there's a wick candle at 45, you know, at the 45 level on the ES. You know, if they're going to have enough volume, they'll blow through it. And if they don't, they won't blow through it. That's all it is.
I like what he does in the sense that he educates people and gets them into markets. I like people like Tim Sykes I had on the show, like yourself. You get people interested in markets, but I agree with you. The marketing, do you know his story?
No.
He says that he was kidnapped by the market makers. They tied him up in a warehouse.
That's nonsense.
They told him the secrets to the market, and then they let him go create a YouTube channel with a million plus subscribers.
So, you know,
who would believe that?
Who would believe that? It's like me being kidnapped by the aliens. You know?
Exactly.
It's the stupidest thing.
But I'm pretty sure you told me that you were abducted by the aliens.
Yeah, it was.
Wait, let's keep going. So we talked about the crash. We talked about your experience at the first firm. You took a break, did the restaurant thing, but then you got involved.
No, then I got into high technology after that, right?
Right.
And then I spent literally like the all the way up to 9/11, I basically...
So were you trading during 9/11?
Not much. So I was trading just for myself because there was so much money. First of all, so the year 1997 to the year 2000, the amount of money that was available.
Yeah.
Like people, I just still say to people, you have no idea the IPO craze at that point. The stocks would come out at like, you know, price of 20, 200 the next day, 400 the day after. Like stocks would, you know, would move.
You don't see that today.
You just don't see that. You don't see the kind of moves. I mean, I used to know
that is crazy.
I knew people who were like, you know, who were waiters who would get an allocation of $100 and they would have you know, $500,000 in their account in a year, which
That's
is
crazy.
Insane. It was really, really insane.
What drove that? Was that inflows just because everybody was riding the dot-com?
Everybody was
craze.
Riding the dot-com.
If
bubble,
you just put dot-com you know, in your ticker,
correct.
Your stock went up.
It was just
up.
Insane. There was a, you know, the famous one was pet.com,
right.
Which was a, you know, company that was, again, 20 years ahead of its time, you know, sold pet food. But, you know, that basically was, all of them were raising billions upon billions upon billions of dollars. And the thing is, the stocks were trading, you know, like they were trading dollar-wide, $50 range per day. I mean, you know, you could drive a truck through those ranges. It was so easy. Just go bid ask, and you know, you had 1,000 shares. You could make $1,000 a minute, which was like, I know people would go crazy. You can't do that now, even in the S&P. It was just insane at how much money there was there.
And it was all long, right? Everything was long.
It was all long.
Nobody's a short seller.
Right. Nobody was short, right? Of course, because you know, it was a uniform market. And I actually, you know, we'll talk about that. I think that's the right bias.
To be long.
To be long, yeah.
You know, this last year, my trading has done really well because of that. Yeah. I really stopped selling
we'll
get to that. All right.
Let's talk about what I learned about all my own flaws.
Exactly. I want to talk about FXCM though.
Yeah.
I want to hear about your time there.
Okay, so what happens then? So 2000, 9/11 happens. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, the tech business just simply dies, just completely dies, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting there basically bored out of my mind trying to figure out what do I do next? And I pick up this magazine called SFO, Stock Futures Options, which was like at that time there used to be magazines, you know? People used to read magazines.
Someone listening to this is going to be like 13 and be like, what's a magazine?
What's a magazine? And this lady, some guy wrote an article, and I was like, about options, right? And I traded options quite a lot, so I'm like, this guy is like 100% wrong about everything he wrote. So for some reason, I just...
Typical Boris take right
there.
I was like... This guy's an idiot.
I was like, I decided, the editor's name was on the thing, and I just like, they were out of Chicago, and I just decided, just on the luck, I called her up and I said, can I talk to Gail Austin? I said, this article is totally wrong. The guy has no fucking clue what he's talking about. And I just ran to her, and she's like sitting in that corner, and she goes, you so smart? You write the article for
That's me. So funny.
And I'm like, what? She goes, yeah, you're so smart. You think you're so smart? You write the article for next month. So I'm like, I wrote the article.
All right.
And I was like, okay, fine. I wrote the article. And she publishes it. And she was like, okay, what are you doing for me? I'm like, well, she goes, what are you doing for me next month? I go, next month? What is it? I didn't realize I was on contract.
You're hired now, right?
She's like, what do you do for me? So that's how basically what happens. I started writing for her. I just started to express all these, trading opinions that I had. And it was a lot of fun. And then there was an ad for, hey, we're looking for an education manager for this company, this Forex guy. I didn't even know what Forex was. Hmm. But the only reason why I responded to it was because it was an overnight position. I was like, oh, this is great. I can work overnight and I can trade stock index futures during the day.
Sure.
Perfect, for me. And I went in, and that was FXCM. And basically what happened is I went in there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and those guys kept me there till 7 at night. Drew had literally made me interview every single person in that firm.
Really?
Was interviewing me. And then by the end of the day, they were like, we want you on our team.
Yeah.
And I just, I simply landed at the right place at the right time. When I started FXCM, they were at 55 Water, and they had a whole, trading floor on the thing, and they had one quarter of the floor. The rest of there was literally desks that were just like folded down.
Right.
Just folded down, right. Down desk. And within like 6 months, half the floor was there, and within 1 year,
the whole
floor was there, and within 2 years, we had two floors on the thing, and it was just insane. The insanity of growth that we had in that company was beyond.
What do you think drove that?
Well, because Forex really took off. Retail Forex really, really took off. It was the first time people had a chance to kind of speculate, get into the market.
What year is this?
This is 2004.
Right, so we're coming out of the tech bubble crash,
right. Coming
we're
out
starting
tech bubble,
to move higher
right,
now,
right.
Going back towards those
right.
all-time
and,
highs.
And then Euro, and also it was an age of high interest rates, so carry was a really great trade, and there was just lots of volatility.
Carry is an overnight hold, correct?
Pound yen was trading 250, so it was like in other words, the movements in pound yen were like 250, 300 pips a day. It was amazing.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, it was a lot
of
fun.
It moves like 80 now.
Yeah, barely. Like the volatility.
Especially euro dollars are now 50,
euro dollar,
60.
Yeah, correct. If your dollar used to move 50, 60 points an hour.
Jeez.
Yeah, an hour, yeah. So it was a completely different time.
At this point, FXCM is mainly spot Forex, not
futures.
They
were doing all spot. They were futures. They always did spot.
No
options, nothing.
Spot.
They were just doing spot. And and they just blew up. And
huge. Because then they became one of like three regulated brokers in America that were.
They went public.
They went public.
They became a billion-dollar company. We had left them before they went public because we got recruited by a competitor of theirs called GFT.
Okay.
And Kathy and I went over there.
Got it.
And worked there. And then after we left GFT, basically Kathy and I just decided to set up shop by ourselves. And literally we've been doing that since 2012. Is that it? I mean, I think that's a... if nothing else, is a testament to just survivability that we're still in the business.
I think that's one thing I've noticed as I've sat down with, like I said, guys with a lot of experience.
Yeah.
They are hard to kill. You and Kathy are hard,
to kill. That's it. Well, she's really hard to kill.
She's
really hard to kill.
When did you two first come together, you and Kathy?
At FXCM. What happened was at FXCM, this is what happened. At FXCM, I was doing the overnight. She was like director of research, right? And again, I was bored. And I was like, the sales guys on the desk have zero idea what to say to customers, in the overnight trade, because they're like, they were just sales guys. So I'm going to write a note you know, when I get in the morning, telling them, hey, this is what's happening. This is what the market is moving. This is what the euro is doing. This was the data. You know, like it was a one-page memo that I used to circulate to sales. And they all loved it. And then Kay saw it, and she's like, oh, this is really good. And she had like one page. Daily FX was literally one page, you know, one-page website. And she's like, you know, do you think maybe you could do this, you know, for Daily FX? I said, yeah, sure, why not? You know, let's see how it goes. And we literally started Daily FX. That website, by the way, got sold for $35 million later on to IG. Wow. But like that was the beginning. And then within a year, we had like four people working for us. And then, you know, then we had like eight people working for us. And it was its own little monster. It became huge. And I still remember, like, the other thing is, how do we get on TV? Because there was very few FX analysts at the time. FX was actually kind of a big space. And I used to just write these really irreverent, you know, pieces. Like, you know, I remember that my first quote that I ever got in MarketWatch was, I don't know what's more incredible, the fact that Alan Greenspan actually believes the economy is growing or the market actually believed him, you know? and I was like, I know I was writing it for myself. I didn't, you know, I was just writing it for
sales. But it took off.
And like all of a sudden they go, hey, you know you're in MarketWatch? I'm like, what? And they're like, MarketWatch pulled that quote. They loved anything that was just, that's, you know, all cheeky, you know?
And I think what's cool about you and Kathy, what it seems like is from the jump, you both complemented each other really well.
We did. And we, to this day, we're still up because we are absolutely the most opposite human beings you can possibly imagine, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I don't believe in astrology, but we are born literally 6 months apart from each other to the day. We have the same birthday, but just 6 months. And we could literally, we are
polar
like
opposites.
This, polar opposites in every fashion.
So to FXCM, they become a big retail broker.
Yeah.
The main broker for a period
right.
of time.
You know, we travel the world. We, you know, they have global customer base.
Are they making traders? Are traders on their platform making money?
Well, you know, like, of course not. Like, right. You know, first of all, you have to understand that.
Of course not.
Of course not. You
know, that's why they're booming.
Because that's why they're booming.
Because guys are trying to trade Forex from their house and getting blown out.
Well, you know, the point is, look, let's be honest with you. No, if you're trading, right, you're in a pool of competition where only like 10 or 15% of people are going to succeed,
if that,
you know, and that's just the nature of the beast, you know, in any, like does every restaurateur make money? You know,
no.
then, you know, like no restaurant would ever go out of business. How many people restaurants go out of business? Restaurants, every time you're trading, it's a small business.
Yeah.
It's what it is. You know, and small business always, the point is that as an entrepreneur, what you need is lots and lots of attempts, right? The more attempts you make, the more success, the more chance, the more times you try a restaurant, the more likely you're going to get better at it.
Yeah.
And that's the same kind of a thing with trading. But the reason most people, you know, lose because they quit in the first restaurant. You know, you need like 10 restaurants before you actually get a concept that works.
That's really
and get
point.
The knowledge going. And that's the thing. So yeah, no, of course people, you know, and the whole model of brokerage was it was a dealer based model. So it means you are in off exchange markets. We'll talk about this, with the difference between futures and CFDs. In off exchange markets, the dealers are making the market, right? That means you are trading against the dealer. Now, it's not nearly as nefarious as people like make it out.
When they're taking the other side of your trade.
The point is, they're not taking the other side of your trade.
Correct.
They couldn't care less who you are.
They're putting their own trades on.
You are an amalgamated number to them. Like there's, you know, 1,000 of their customers are long the euro. Now they're short the euro because 1,000 of their customers. They're not going after your position.
Joe Schmo.
They could give a flying F about, you know, your position. They're trying to balance their books because that's their job. Their job is to be the intermediary, but you know they're just trying to make the spread. They're just trying to balance the books and make sure the position is this. I mean, just, you know, we got hosted at FXCM. I'll tell you what happened. The carry trade, which was a trade where you got paid. The carry trade is where you buy a currency with a high interest rate yield and finance that purchase with a currency with low interest rate. And at that point, of course, the U.S. dollar. And at that point, it was actually the pound. The pound had like an 8-9% yield, and the yen had zero because Japan has been in zero interest rate policy for as long as everybody lived at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, we had a huge Japanese client base.
Really?
And the Japanese, unlike Americans, have discipline. And they would just literally hold their pound-yen positions, not for a day, not for a week, not for a month. They would just hold and collect the roll and collect the roll. And in the meantime, the market kept going up and up and up. And our dealer, you know, had a large negative position. And that negative position, like, just, you know, cost the firm. We took a
Huge
hit. You know, like almost an existential hit. And after that, it was funny. After that, we went to a what's called an NPP model, where we no dealing model. We just started to pass off the flow to our market makers. We didn't want to take any more principal risk
because it was too much risk.
Because that was too much. And again, this is a good example. Just one wrong decision. You can make a million great decisions. You make one wrong decision, it becomes catastrophic. That's what people don't understand about the markets.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Now, the carry trade. I've heard trader Nick talk about this a lot. I have guys that are now trading futures and they'll hold some of these positions overnight, get positive carry.
Yeah.
Is that still something you think some of these...
Unfortunately, the problem is the interest rate regime right now across the world...
Has brought them all much closer.
Has brought them all, and it's so disfavorable.
It is.
And the dealers used to offer really favorable terms. Now they offer really unfavorable terms. Sure. As a matter of fact, there are play situations now where even if you have a positive currency, you're still getting charged money.
Yes.
Because dealers will charge you
commissions
money.
Or whatever they'll call it.
Oh, no, even overnight rolls. Like the overnight rolls are actually negative, even though they should be positive. Because dealers just don't want to take the risk. Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's far less attractive than it used to be.
Okay.
But yeah, it still exists.
So let's talk about CFDs and futures.
Okay.
So you're now involved with a futures funding company. I'm now shifting over into futures.
Right.
I want to talk about the differences between some of these firms. But first, let me ask you about CFDs.
Sure.
Because you've been around for a long time.
Right.
CFDs were not allowed, really, by regulated U.S. brokers since 2008 with Dodd-Frank. Is that correct?
Right. Correct.
So before that, CFDs, which are contract for difference, you could trade them
no,
in America?
No. CFDs were never allowed. Let's make that clear.
Okay.
The reason why CFDs is basically a European term for futures, if you think about it. What is a CFD? Contract for difference, and what is a future? It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a virtual contract. It's a contract for the underlying, right? To deliver a certain amount of underlying at a certain price. You're going to settle that contract at a certain price, right?
Sure.
And typically, futures, because they were hedging products, used to deliver the actual physical product, right? You would deliver barrels of oil or bushels of corn. But when it came to financial futures, they were like, this is stupid.
Yeah.
Why don't we just deliver the dollar difference? Because that's what it is. And when you think about it, when you're delivering dollar difference, that's the same thing as a CFD. In a CFD, you're just delivering the dollar difference between what you paid and what the market is now.
Sure.
And if you win, you get a credit. If you lose, you get a debit. That's all it is.
I follow that.
Yeah.
So
the point is, the reason why they don't allow them in the U.S. is because Chicago Mercantile Exchange, I think,
don't want that.
Of course,
that's what I was going to say.
It's an exact
because all these different brokers can make different pricing for these CFDs.
It's not just that. You can make right now. You know, you can trade oil, you can trade gold, you can trade stock index futures.
Mm-hmm.
If you trade CFDs in for the rest of the world, you could trade CFDs on Tesla. You could trade CFDs on AI companies, on Nvidia, whatever. Any financial product can become a derivative, essentially a stub, a little stub, a difference between what the current market price is and that. And then, of course, you can lever it. And that's the thing. They don't want people to lever.
Right.
Now, the regulators don't want to lever, too, because there's two things. It's unregulated. You don't have a actual physical price.
It's not centralized.
Centralized price. And that's a big thing.
That's a big thing. Yeah. And that's why a lot of people now that are shifting.
That's why you saw, you know, MFF, TFF, and all those guys get into trouble.
Right. And also, they're making their own market in a sense where they're using their own broker, pricing the CFD however they want.
Right, right.
Now, everybody's shifting over to futures right now,
right.
And everybody's honestly loving it. Everybody I'm sure your community, you're seeing the same thing.
Yes.
It's like a cleaner market, people are saying. They feel like it's a better place to be.
Well, here's the thing about futures. Whether you're in Dubuque or Dubai, it doesn't matter. If you're trading the NASDAQ, your highest bid, first to entry, in other words, your timestamp is first on the, you will get that trade ahead of every hedge fund in the world. It's a centralized feed.
Exactly.
That's the whole point. So your experience is uniform anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge psychological advantage to people.
100%.
Right. Now, I don't want to, like, you know, rain water on CFDs. CFDs are actually priced off of futures. If you look at NASDAQ CFDs US 30, where do you think they're deriving their prices from? They have to derive their prices off futures because that's a centralized market. The thing with CFDs is most of the markets are very tight. And most of them are not really, you know, in discrepancy because competition creates, you know, you can't have like one guy be $5 off on NASDAQ. It's impossible.
Right.
Because there'll be so much arbitrage.
Right.
So it's not like there is a huge discrepancy, but there's enough doubt, you know, in traders' minds, and there's enough doubt on a trade-by-trade basis that certainly, you know, futures have been taken off tremendously because of that.
Have you seen any or worked with any huge futures traders, guys that have crushed it in certain futures markets?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, we have guys at Apex who've, you know, pulled out more than $1 million out of them.
What do they trade mostly? NASDAQ?
NASDAQ.
I mean, why do you think that is?
Well, NASDAQ is by far the most volatile.
Right.
So NASDAQ has two advantages. The NASDAQ future, so when you trade CFD, it's interesting. What do people trade in CFDs? They trade US 30. Why do they trade the US 30, which is the Dow Jones? Because it's a five-figure product, right? Right? It's a five-figure product. In the US, nobody trades the Dow Jones because the Dow Jones is a sleepy little index and has like literally 1/20th the volume of the S&P, right? Everybody trades the S&P. But the S&P is a $5,000 product. It's very, very small on a point-by-point basis, and it's really, really thick, meaning that to move it, you need a lot of volume. So, you know, it's really hard to make move. Now, NASDAQ has the advantage of having both, which is it's a big product, it's a five-digit product, and it's really thin. Like it's 10 contracts per, you know, per level at most, meaning that, you know, you hit NASDAQ will go 20 points in 1 minute if you want it to be.
Right.
Now 20 points in 1 minute is $40 on a tiniest, a micro contract,
right.
$400
on a
large.
Yeah.
You know, you literally could make $1,000
in
2 minutes if you're on the right side of the trade.
Right. Whereas on S, you can do that as well on ES.
Yeah.
It's just going to be less movement.
Less movement. You got to do much larger size.
You
and again, there's a difference between a thick and a thin layer, a ladder, meaning that the S&P is usually 400 or 500 up, meaning 400 on the bid, 400 on the offer. NASDAQ is like 10 up, you know, and sometimes it's 2 up.
Okay.
And so you know, when somebody decides to sweep the ladder, somebody decides to buy all the offers or hit all the bids, it just flies.
It moves. Would you say that, like, as a new trader into futures, NASDAQ is the right one to be looking at?
Well, the great thing about futures, and this is where the CME really kind of, I think, you know, made their bones, they went into something called the micro contract.
Right, because they opened it up to everybody.
They opened up to a micro contract is only $2 a point on the NASDAQ.
But the commissions on the micros kind of suck.
Yeah, the commissions suck. Okay, so this
That's
is...
That's a typical Wall okay. Street thing, isn't it, Boris?
Right.
We're going to make it so that the poor people can trade it, but we're going to charge
it
more.
So here's why I love futures prop.
Tell me.
This is something that nobody ever talks about, and you only understand it if you've traded futures for real like I have,
yeah.
And you've traded CFDs for real like I have, and you understand all the mechanics of the thing. So if you trade futures for real, mm-hmm. right, I'm not exaggerating, there have been days where I have paid my futures broker $500 and I've made 50. Like, no exaggeration. That's how much, you know, if you're trading frequently, and you do every
commissions
time you
will
trade,
run you up.
Commissions will just run you up. And these go, oh, that's why you don't want to trade frequently. We'll talk about that, yes or no. Here's the beautiful thing about futures prop. You don't care. It's net. The difference is that in futures prop, you still made that $50, but you don't see the $500 in commission. It's just the $50 net to your thing. And here's the other beautiful thing. On a personal day, like I would have sometimes a day where I would, you know, tough day, lots and lots of positioning, I'd be down $300 or $400 by commission price alone. Now I'm like, oh, I'm actually down $400. Don't want to make this next trade, right? If I'm in a futures prop, which is virtual money, what do I care? I have zero concern.
Right.
This is something people completely underappreciate, the ability to be able to trade as much as you want, as many times as you want, because it's not real money. It's hugely valuable because that gives you the opportunity then to come back. Because I've had, you know, 10 bad trades, and if you're in real money, you're like, I don't want to take the 11th trade. But it's the 11th and the 12th or the 13th trade that actually recovers the whole value. And I've, you know, then I'm up on the day.
Yeah.
Now, I can do that in a futures prop. I can't do it on my own account.
The guy that's about to walk in here for my next interview has a 14% win rate this year since the first 2 months, January, February.
Yeah.
He's already been paid out $13,000 from his futures firm. He trades exactly like that. Loss, 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 small. That 11th trade is the big winner.
The 11th trade.
And he doesn't talk about commissions at all.
Because they don't matter.
They don't matter.
They don't
matter. Right.
Yes, they go against your net P&L. You have a, you know, $2,500 budget on P&L, whatever,
right.
$50,000.
Sure.
And it's, what do you care? It's the next trade that matters, you know?
It's a great
point.
But you
will never appreciate that if you've never traded live versus prop.
So everybody listening should take your advice.
Yeah.
Do you think CFDs are dead in America, or do you think they're going to be worked around and we're going to come back?
Dead. I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, there's talk.
Did you say dead? You think they're dead?
I think they're dead. There's talk that, you know, if Trump comes, you know, becomes president, they may loosen regulations. I doubt it because I my feeling is the Chicago Mercantile guys, first of all, are very, very tight with the, you know, Trump administration.
They must be feeling like they're getting a grip of everything. Why would they let go?
Yeah, well, they literally, I cannot tell you, I think they're like at $200 billion now. I mean, they just literally own the world, you know, as far as trading goes.
They'll be at a trillion soon.
And, you know, and the thing is that I think the other way that's interesting is happening is a lot of people from Singapore, people from Malaysia are discovering the beauty of futures, the sort of the beauty of centralized markets. They're like, oh my God, you know, there's never, you know, a doubt on my fill. You know, I can see my fill.
Exactly.
So, you know, there's never an argument. There's never an argument about my P&L.
Right.
You know,
like, and that's all you hear in the CFD space, right, is slippage and poor execution, and they screwed me, the broker screwed me. You can't have that. I haven't seen a single futures trader ever say that.
Right.
And
no,
so
you're gonna get bad fills. You're gonna get crazy vertical moves. And this is the thing. The other thing about futures. If you're going to come in with size, mm-hmm, like, let's say, just even, I'll give you some, this is the other thing, people go, oh, I trade 50 contracts. I'm like, I know you're lying, because if you're trading 50 contracts NASDAQ, you won't get filled. And if you're hitting the button and you're getting filled, it's not a real deal, because you, 50 contracts on NASDAQ, you're going to spray it at least four or five wide, meaning that it's going to get five at one level, five another. It's just not that deep in real life.
Sure.
And futures prop firms that are using a real market feed, not like a bogus market feed, are going to give you, you know, all those, you know, bad fills. There's no escaping of, you know, friction, market friction. The key thing that you want is just honesty and transparency, right? That's all you want. You just want, you know, you want an accurate accounting of all your transactions. That's what I think people are looking for.
When you go to barcharts.com and you look at the volume that's coming through on futures markets, the bonds have like three times, the 10-year has three times the amount of volume as NASDAQ.
Right.
Why is that? Do you know anything about bond traders?
Because it's all institutional. That's the thing.
That's what
And actually, they've introduced the micro bonds, which is a, you know, really, really good product. And, you know, if you have, I think it's fascinating you were asked that, because I think FX traders, bonds are a very fundamental trade.
Yeah.
You know, they're a very, very fundamental trade.
Based on interest rates and yields.
Currency is essentially a short-term bond. That's what people don't understand. Like, you know, currencies are an interest rate yielding bond. It's what is a currency? It's like a one-day or a two-day bond, because it has a yield on it, you know, attached to it, right?
Sure.
And so those two markets are incredibly interconnected.
Yeah.
So, you know, retail traders who are trading
Forex should look at bonds.
And you know, there's availability now, like, really, really nicely. And of course, because the micros are fully tied to the big ones, meaning that they're literally tied, like, electronically. You can't really change the price of one versus changing the price of the other.
No.
You're going to get a very good, you know, you're going to get a very good fill.
When you were trading futures, even back in the day, because now we have the micros and most of us are trading the minis.
Right.
Were there guys trading bigger than minis?
Yes, there was the full S&P contract,
which
was,
and that's going to be another 10x,
right,
in terms of tick value,
right,
compared to the
correct,
mini.
Correct. It was.
So those are the big.
Those
traders.
Were the biggest. Those are the guys. You know,
those just are come, the big
yeah,
traders.
If you trade 100 full, it was like, there was a guy named Marty Schwartz. He had a great book called Pitbull.
Yeah,
Pitbull. You know,
that's what he did.
He traded the full S&P.
I didn't know that. He turned 18,000 into like couple million. That was his thing.
Man, the great book, by the way.
But a lot of losses. Marty lost a lot of money in the beginning.
One of the greatest trading books you can ever read. Not for strategy, but just for
the story
and to understand the whole journey process. He's a really brilliant guy. Yeah.
Speaking of Marty, let me just sidebar for a second. I had a question I wanted to touch on. Who were some of the most influential traders you've either met or worked with? You mentioned the guy that was connected to George Soros that you wrote letters to.
Right, Andrew. Well, you know,
I'm surprised Soros didn't take you in. Eastern European Jew from the Brotherhood, bring me
exactly,
in kind of thing.
Exactly. I do have a huge amount of respect for the way Soros trades. You know, you can have all sorts of different views.
Put the politics aside.
Put the politics
aside. It.
As a trader, he's a brilliant trader.
Savage.
Part of it was because he had this just relentless East European non-sentimental view of the world.
Yeah.
No, a non-sentimental view of the world. Like, if he was wrong, he was out. He just couldn't care less.
Oh, interesting.
You know, he would just let go.
Unemotional.
Unemotional in a way that I think is very hard. Unego. He had like no ego. He had a tremendous amount of personal ego, but no ego when it comes to the market. I think that's a great thing to separate. You know, you want to believe in yourself, but you don't want to believe in your trade.
That's a great piece of advice.
You know,
who else?
You know, so he was great. I've always, you know, Tudor Jones was great. For, you know, like when I was growing up, I looked at him as a you know,
still one of the best.
Yeah, still one of the best traders. You know, it's funny.
Come on, admit it. It's ICT. He's your favorite.
I trade very, very differently from what everybody on YouTube trades as. You know, I trade incredibly negative risk rewards. I trade short term.
And you and me definitely trade similar.
And I, you know, I'm not very good at giving conventional advice because that's not what I do.
That's why I'm having you on the show, of course.
So, you know, if you want to day trade, I'm your guy. If you have a much longer patient point of view and you can go for, you know, 2x, 3x, 4x, those are your trades. If you are a guy who says, I'm 70% accurate and I have a 3x trade setup, you're lying through your teeth 100%. Like the single easiest way I know somebody does not actually trade for a living is that sentence.
Right. 70% win rate.
Because we all know that mathematically, that is that
you'd be a gajillionaire.
You'd be a billionaire by Tuesday.
Right.
You know, it's impossible to achieve.
What's your win rate, do you think? Do you know?
Okay, so I trade with a, what I do, the way we trade, or at least the way I trade, is I trade multiple entries. So it's not a martingale in a sense that I never add to a position. I'm in a position, I get stopped out. But then if I go, I'm following a particular trade setup, right? If the trade setup fails, I'll go the next time the trade setup occurs, twice the size, and then twice the size. I will do that up to 5 times, okay? So that's 31-1 loss ratio. In other words, if I get blown out of my catastrophic, you know, final trade, it's 31-1, right? So this is where mathematics really comes in, very interesting. If the stock market is a 55-45 long only trade. If you go back literally from 1950s.
Say that again for everybody, because that's important.
The stock market is a 55-45 long only trade, right? Yep. So if you assume, let's say I have no edge whatsoever, like my setup is just purely random, it's a 50-50
setup.
You're
just buying.
And I'm just saying, like, my analysis of the market, my technical analysis that I, you know, that I'm constantly working on,
okay,
zero actual alpha, like zero predictive value. It's a 50-50, it's a coin toss, right? Okay. So what happens is, if it's a 50-50, I lose 31, you know, on every 31st trade, I lose. But if I am long only, if I only take long only setups and they are 55-45 just by the statistics of the market, and it's still a 50-50, in other words, I have no inherent ability to win on any given trade because my setup is horrible, I'm just guessing, right? Those statistics put me to 50-1. So that means if I'm at 55-45, I will fail 1 out of 50 times, right? But if I'm trading, you know, 1-to-2 ratios, I'm winning 31 times. So that 31 minus 50 gives me 20 wins out of every 50 attempts I make. So in other words, when I'm making 50 trades in a row, right, statistically, I'm supposed to lose them all.
Sure.
But because the stock market is a 55-45, just statistically, no edge whatsoever, I only lose 1 out of 31 of those trades. That means I get to keep 20 of those wins. That's basically what I just kind of realized.
So basically, like a 30% or 40% win rate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't even count it because
I understand the math.
We look at the trade cycle.
For sure.
So in other words, I'm going to make 100 trades in a month, just for argument's sake. I'm going to make 100 trades in a month. I'm going to lose 2 of those, right, for 31x.
Yeah.
And so that means I'm going to make 98x the other way minus 31x. I'm going to make, like, you know, 20x.
Makes sense.
Right.
So you and I trade similarly, I think, more than you realize. When I'm trading, I am definitely more long biased, like I was telling you before, and that's made a big difference for me. My win rate is about 66% this year over the last 12 months, but my average risk reward, I'm aiming for 1R. If I risk 10 points on the ES or 8 points, I look to make 8, but I'm taking profit at 6. I'm taking some off the table, I'm locking a stop.
Right.
So I'm not realizing that full 1R gain.
Right.
And statistically, people will be like, Austin, you're leaving money on the table, you're not following a system. I know that. I know I'm using a framework, and all I try to do is end the day green. I have a 70% end the day green rate. So with TradeZilla, have you used TradeZilla yet?
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Me too. I like the guy Umar that's running the company. Yeah. That's helped me a lot because it shows me the discretionary edge. You are, as much as that was statistical, but you're very discretionary in your trading, aren't you?
Yeah, no.
And taking profit and taking an entry, it's very about fear.
As my 11-year-old, who knows me better than anybody else,
Daddy likes the quick money.
Daddy likes to get paid. She says Daddy likes to get paid.
So, like, for example, if you take a trade on NASDAQ with a tight stop.
Yeah.
And let's say it moves halfway to your take profit relatively quickly. What will you do?
Okay, first of all my trades, my scalp trades on NASDAQ are 10 point stop.
Yeah, so okay, that's tight. That's just tight.
That is just it.
But that's tight.
Yeah, it's tight. So, you know, so I'm gonna get clipped. So I will sometimes offer it plus five. Sometimes I'll offer it plus four. It doesn't matter. The great thing about futures is you can buy bid.
Yeah.
You know, I always try to buy bid. So
get you a better price.
Very much, if you can save the spread, you already have the edge in your favor.
100%.
So I buy bid, and then I will, if I'm not at limit, like if it's not quite getting to my limit, I'll just try to offer at offer, at ask. I'll sell at ask.
Yeah.
That alone will just, you know, give me the spread. So the way I work it is my first trade, remember I have like, let's say five trade cycles. I'm gonna do the same trade five times as it sets up.
Right.
In the first time that it gives me the signal, I may get out early because I don't care. Because you know, again, I have no risk. Remember, I've not lost anything. The second trade, I've already lost 10 points. So now I got to make at least 5 points just to get to break even. So maybe I'll go to plus seven, plus eight and get out of those, right? But a third trade, fourth trade, I got to manage those essentially at 10-10, you know, at that point. So yeah. So, you know, it all becomes a little bit discretionary. Absolutely. You know.
How long do you trade each day?
So I'm a junkie. And again, there's zero reason you need to trade the way I do. There are guys in my room.
You and me just like it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like on Friday, I did 34 trades. I start at 4 a.m. and I'll trade to like.
Were you trading that early? NASDAQ?
NASDAQ, yeah. I mean, you know, like.
You get good volume at 4 a.m?
You get the European. The thing is, if you watch the markets, there are certain very repeatable behavior patterns.
Sure.
I'm sure you've noticed them.
Yeah. For example, London Open, New York
there's
Open.
There's a London Open. Yeah. There's a London Open. Depending on where we're at, you know, it's gonna be, if the market is bullish, they're gonna sweep it up, and you have a chance to just buy the breakout. I will tell you something very, very funny. I have lots of interesting algos. We have written great algos both for CFDs and for futures. NinjaTrader algos, all of them, you know, all my programmers are working really hard overtime in getting this stuff, and it's great. And if you are like sort of, you just want to do algorithmic trading where you just take one of my setups and it automatically trades it, it's great. But these days, I trade nothing but the 8-period moving average.
That's it.
That's it. That's it. You know, I am looking, and it's unbelievable at how much money is, you know, how much money you can scalp out if you're just on the right side of that average.
That's it.
It's insane.
And how many people will try to fight that average as it's moving higher and they try to sell it and sell it and sell it. And it's just like throw a buy in and shut up.
This is where it really opened up my eyes. So I'm running like my, I already passed a couple of, you know, Apex accounts and I'm running the next one in a very, very methodical small manner where I'm just, you know, trading very, very small numbers. So I have a huge amount of data at this point, like 500 trades. And when I look at my trades, literally 90% of my wins are on the long side. And it's like maybe $100 worth of wins. Like,
on the short side.
And why? Because this is my greatest weakness is I am a non-conventional person like you. I like to fight the crowd. And I'm like, you know, if it's going up, it's going up.
Middle finger to the authority.
John Cougar Mellencamp, I fight authority, authority always wins, was literally my
theme song
of my whole life. But I realized, you know, you're a moron. You're literally a moron.
In the markets, don't pay to be like that.
It doesn't.
We can be like that outside the markets.
That's why I say, you know, it doesn't matter if you're trading the 1-minute chart, the 10-minute chart, the daily chart, the weekly chart. Buy the freaking dip is literally the strategy in the market. There's only two positions you really want to have. You want to be flat or you want to be long.
Right there. That's a good nugget right there. Because of market drift, correct?
Because of market drift.
Because of inflows.
Because of
pension funds and all the money that flows into the market.
And this is very specific to the U.S. stock market and maybe the German stock market. In other words, it's specifically for growth capitalist
economies. This isn't Japan. This is not the pound. This is not the U.K. stock market. It's not the FTSE.
Right.
This is different. It is America.
Although Japan is now almost at
is it at all-time highs?
All-time highs. You know,
good for them. 20, 30 years later.
It's very hard to trade the Nikkei.
But you know how I know you're not a short?
Yeah.
You still have your hair. All the bears I know, the people like no offense, Lucci. Lucci's one of the options guys. He's a notorious short, got no hair. The shorts against the market age you. It's very difficult.
It ages you.
And we all look at the market and we all go, like right now, AI. AI is and it's a one stock market almost. NVIDIA, and now they just added a SMCI to the S&P at all time highs basically. Yeah, it's a one sector market,
right,
you know it's got to pull back.
Right.
But that doesn't mean to be short.
No. And it's always, and it's generally, the rule of thumb when you're shorting is that it will pull back after you're margined out.
Mm.
It's always, that's the number one rule of life. It's when you're stopped out that you're going to be pulled back.
Wait till you see this episode I have going up this week with Gary Cardone. It's Grant Cardone's brother.
Oh, yeah.
He had 7 margin calls against him on Bitcoin last year.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Interesting,
wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Last thing.
Yes.
Speak to the audience about anything you'd like to share when it comes to the prop firm CFD funding space that you think they should know. You've been involved in it for a long time.
Right. So here's the thing. There is absolutely no better way to learn the markets than to trade an evaluation prop account. Because it puts you into the exact same mindset and the exact same prices that the market is involved in without any personal risk. Just think about this. If you're lucky, yeah, maybe you'll get funded for $50,000 at a cost of like, you know, $100 buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. That's not the value of it. The value of it is the actual process of learning. You can take 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 of those accounts, and you'll still never spend as much money as you would on your one account that you funded for yourself. You can lose $1,000 in futures in one day flat. You couldn't do that in evaluation, you know, cases in 1 month or 2 months. And it's the process of learning about who you are, what you are, you know, and what the markets are, that is just invaluable. And then, you know, if you get good at it, you're funded, again, with no risk of your own money. I don't know of any, it's the ultimate asymmetric. People always talk about, I want to trade 10x trades, I want to trade 100x trades. It's the ultimate 100x trade. You spend 100, you may be able to make 100,000, at the end of the journey. Even if you make 5,000, the asymmetrical payoff is just tremendous. The other thing is, you know, people are focused on trading for a living. Don't. Trade for life. Meaning, make it a gig, make it a hobby. If you trade well, you get to a point where you say, doesn't matter what the market is, doesn't matter what the market does, I will be able to make some money out of the market at any given time because I know I have the day trading skills to do so. And that is an incredible sense of accomplishment and confidence that you cannot have anywhere else. And that's what, you know, prop trading really gives you. That's why I'm a huge believer in it. You get the chance to really participate in the markets without blowing up a huge amount of personal money.
I love it.
Yeah.
Where should everybody find you? BK Traders?
BKTraders.com or at FX Flow. You can tell, you know, like even though it's I no longer trade FX.
Although and me both, we're stuck with FX and our freaking tag handles.
Exactly.
We're not even trading Forex anymore.
Trading futures and Forex, right. But yes. But it's fine. I still trade, by the way, tons of CFDs. You know, and we have a great relationship with a CFD broker called ACAP, who we love. So there's, you know, it's not one or the other. It's just different products, and they're all really, really valuable, and they're all really great. And I think people should do it. And this is the way to put your toe in the water. This is really the perfect way to enter the markets.
Also, everybody, make sure you check out Boris on the Trading Battle. He's hosting the Trading Battle.
Right, exactly. And we trade the Trading Battle, which is great because there you get a whole bunch of different traders with completely different mindsets and approaches. Really fascinating to delve into their methodologies. So hopefully you guys will like that.
Last thing.
Yeah.
Who is one trader that you know that I need to sit with for the podcast? Who would be an interesting conversation for me? This is our second one. We did a virtual one. Now we're in person. We're already like, you know how I am. Who do you think I should sit with?
This is tough.
Maybe your wife. Would she be down?
No, my wife is not. This is the interesting thing. My wife would be an excellent interview.
Yeah, she worked at a hedge fund.
She's worked for many hedge funds.
Right.
Precisely because she's not a trader. My wife is the exact opposite of a trader in a sense that my wife is a old-fashioned value
investor,
long-short hedge fund investor. And what she will do is she will find a story that is divergent from where the market thinks the story is and will hold on to that position through thick and thin and, you know, dominate in ways that I never could.
Like, strong conviction.
Strong conviction, strong analysis, and more importantly, the ability to kind of manage that position really well. You know, like my wife is up a factor of 100 versus me in terms of the accounts this year because, you know, she's so strong fundamentally. And there are people who really, really like trading that way. Like, in other words, trading positionally, trading fundamentally, and holding on to your convictions really, really well. So yeah, she's
I'll let you think about it then for a guest. If you don't think she'd be great, I'll let you, because you know so many people, so you got to give me somebody good.
Yeah, no, I got to think. I'll come back to you on that. Yeah.
All right. For everybody listening all the way through, we appreciate you very much. Make sure you follow Boris, connect with him. All the links will be down in the description. Boris.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. So great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Bye.